So hi, Andrew.
Hey, Tom.
How you doing? I'm doing good, thanks. So you wrote an article.
Yeah, I've been going down the rabbit hole of Alexander Dugin and also this guy named Charles Upton. I've been reading his book called Dugin on Dugin.
Right.
To try to understand like what is going on in Russia, like from a metaphysical sense.
Yeah.
Besides the horrible war and all that. So I wrote a sort of a general description of my where I'm at so far in my analysis.
Yeah.
In that situation. Yeah.
It's called special operations and the Kali Yuga meditations on the war in Ukraine. No.
Yeah. And so we've decided that we would read it and then talk about it at
right.
the same time.
Today, exactly. Right?
Okay, I'll begin reading it. So it begins with a quote from Leonard Cohen. There's a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say there isn't. That's the quote from Leonard Cohen. According to Putin, there is no war or invasion of Ukraine. There are just special operations. The bald lie of this is remarkable to understate the case. Russian special operations are code for the mass rape and death of scores of innocent people. And it should not be denied that Putin is a mass murderer by now. Let us be very blunt about that before we go forward with geopolitical complexities, make moral equivalence arguments, or blame the West for all the world's sins. There have always been mass murderers and tyrants east and west, and Putin can join the bad company of Attila the Hun, Potpol Stalin, and so many others. I will not say the H word. Of course, the United States and NATO have had their share of notorious special operations in the past and present, undoubtedly. But on the scales of justice, some places are freer than others, and some killers are way worse. So let's not make the mistake of justifying Putin's mad butchering because of our own liberal guilt. So I guess that's a commentary on the fact that as soon as this war happened, people started saying, in the West, Russell Brand and others, oh, this is the West's fault because of their bad behavior in the past. And it seems to me that that's always the position of the West, right? To blame themselves for everything, the leftist West or the liberal West or the pathological liberal guilt. So what we're saying is that it's our fault, right? And
right.
That's a kind of a comforting position because then it's like a passive aggressive situation. We're in control of all this and,
yeah.
But we're not, Putin's doing what he's doing and we may have created some of the causes and conditions for this to occur, but I just get annoyed by the moral equivalence arguments.
Yeah, no, I think like from my point of view, I always like try to look at it from a microcosm perspective, like for example, like as a couple who just fights, and argues, but the line is crossed when the man is hitting the woman, just to state it bluntly,
Exactly.
So in a relationship, when there's a fight, both are responsible, but that doesn't that doesn't legitimize one person hitting the other person. And so I would go about like this.
Exactly. So I'll read on because I say more or less the same thing.
Yeah.
So however, instead of pointing out the obvious here, let's move on to more important questions. For instance, what is different about this war? Is there anything historically novel going on? And what is the nature of this conflict on a fundamental level? Is this a war of civilizations? Is it about killing a tyrant and saving the Ukrainians and good Russians too? Is this the story of David and Goliath? In many ways, this war follows a predictable pattern. A scapegoat, Ukraine, is chosen to let off the murderous steam of a resentful and dying empire. The increase of fear, panic, and instability created by COVID sets the stage for war. That this war comes at the tail end of a pandemic is not novel. Historically speaking, wars follow plagues and pandemics. And in many ways, this is the same eternal war as always, with the same eternal adversary, a filial war between brothers in arms. And yet, I would argue that there are fundamental ways in which this war is different. So I'm basically setting it up to say, this is like all, you know, like you were just saying, like this war of brothers, or this war of a couple, and,
yeah,
and, you know, it's similar. And then there's a point where it becomes violent. So in this way, it's the same as all other wars. But I want to, and I'm wondering how actually this war is different. That's my next question.
I want
to explore in the rest of the, what I try to explore in the rest of the essay.
Yeah, well, you know, before you go,
of course, answering the question. You know.
Yeah, before you go on, what I find very interesting is the relation you do here, you know, with a correlation between COVID and the war that follows the plague, you know, because that's not really part of the conversation we're having culturally right now, but because I think there is a connection there.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'm not a historian, but I've read in several places that, you know, the 30 Years' War, for example, happened after a massive, I'm not sure about my history here, so I have to be very careful, but mostly wars happen after some kind of major pandemic or instability, or, you know, there is some studies about how dictators are, you know, there was some interesting studies about how dictators are afraid of parasites. Really intense, have this intense relationship with parasites. And when they talk about, when they attack their enemies, they always describe them as being, you know, parasites of some kind.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Mm.
So there's a psychological element to that.
Yeah.
And you see pictures of Putin very distanced from everybody, sitting on his long table and in this very sterile environment.
Yeah, the same with Hitler. And the
obviously being afraid of being poisoned, or being afraid of getting COVID, or afraid of this, you know, this infection.
Yeah, wasn't the language of the imagery of the National Socialists, the Nazis, you know, in regard of the Jews, that they used like snakes and insects to depict them?
And parasites. And they tried to clean the whole of Germany with... you know, all the German factories and that kind of thing. And I think this, and Putin has this image of this purity of Russia, right? So it's always, there's always a purity metaphor going on when wars are created.
Yeah.
And so in this way, it's sort of, it's textbook, you know, and it's very predictable, it seems, from what I've heard, that, you know, this has been boiling up for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so
go on.
No, what did you say?
No, I wanted to say go on.
Okay, so the war of attention. Firstly, the entire world's attention is on Ukraine, for good or ill. Ukraine has already won the war of attention. Even if worse situations exist in Uganda, Yemen, and Afghanistan. Also, the fact that a Jewish comedian is the hero of this war is also significant and surprising, especially in a country with a history of anti-Semitism like Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky has courageously remained in Kiev and projected a spirit of heroism. Ukraine has already become a country of martyrs. In that sense, Putin has already lost the spiritual war, even if he manages to grind Ukraine into dust. On the other side of the mirror, Alexander Dugin has been instrumental in creating the Kremlin's perverse and nihilistic spiritual vision. Contrary to Dugin's hodgepodge mystical metaphysics, this is not a war between civilizations or Atlantis and Eurasia or any of that bullshit. On a fundamental level, this is a war against a bigger war. When a nuclear holocaust is at stake, it's a choice between civilizations and cockroaches. Okay.
Right.
So I think it's kind of interesting that Zelensky is a Jewish comedian. I think that is kind of interesting from an archetypal sense.
Yeah.
So he fits into being a good scapegoat, as the Jews are always scapegoated.
Yeah.
And he also fits into being this person representing the, you know, the decadent imperialistic West with their, you know, entertainment and media, that kind of thing.
Yeah. As far as I understand, he has like this weird Dugin, this weird notion of, I think, doesn't he like view modernity as the...
Oh, we're talking about Dugin now. Dugin has... Go ahead with Dugin. I was just mentioning Zelensky.
But what were you going to say about Dugin? Because this gets kind of interesting for me. Isn't he like looking at modernity as the root cause of all evil, basically, in that conflict and in his worldview?
Of course, yeah. He considers himself to be a traditionalist. And the traditionalists, in a sense, think that we are living in what they call the Kali Yuga age. This is the age of degeneration. And that this age is kind of intensifies until there's a new age, right?
You're right.
So in a way, Dugin is an accelerationist. He wants to intensify the Kali Yuga. But what's really interesting and not clear is on one hand, he's sort of defending tradition and, you know, what he calls the logos of Russia.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, he's very postmodern. And he's saying that, you know, that we've been living in a logocentric era. And he's almost embracing this chaos and saying, you know, so he's very ambiguous.
Hmm.
He's playing two games at once. He's on the one hand he's talking about the logos of Russia, and the other hand he sort of wants to intensify the Kali Yuga,
right?
Or which means also chaos. Or, you know, in Charles Upton's book, he talks about Baba Yuga, who is like the Russian version of Kali, who represents, you know, destruction, chaos. She destroys the old so that the new can come in.
Right.
And that is his vision. And in many ways, there's something very compelling and true about it. But at the same time, this is more of a spiritual vision, really, than a geopolitical one, I would say.
What is it, Andrew, with the Russian Tsar, be it like the actual Tsar or Putin, and like spiritual advisors, like, you know, what
Rasputin.
Rasputin or Dugin, like what is the relationship going on there? You have an idea? Like,
yeah,
because
well,
like both just... seem to be like have a spiritual, you know, you call it a spiritual, the perverse spiritual fantasy going on. And so like, why, what is that?
Well, I mean, Putin has to have a reason for doing what he's doing. And he wants to have a compelling kind of spiritual reason for that too. So he gets the church involved and, you know, talks about the Holy Russian Empire. In a way, it's a very 19th century vision. I was thinking that he's a 19th century figure in the sense that he's just a typical brute, you know.
Right.
Like Napoleon was, basically. You know, Napoleon was probably a cleverer brute, but...
Yeah.
And Dugin is a postmodernist. He's kind of like, he's a postmodernist who's kind of feeding this vision.
What I mean is like, what kind of archetype is Dugin? Because he appears to be like having the same archetype than Rasputin, you know? It's like he's like the guy, the spiritual advisor in the background.
A spiritual advisor.
Who has like this kind
of... Well, he's like the demented priest, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like Alexander talks about the priest and the chieftain and that how they have to have a, you know, strong relationship to run a country.
Right.
And in a way, that's true. You need an intellectual person, then you need a leader. But this is like the perverted dark version of that.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Mm. Or the shadow of that, you could say.
Yeah.
I mean, right. Who knows how actually close... Dugin is to Putin, but you know, from what people have been saying, that this is really a lot of this comes from the seductiveness of Dugin's sort of Heideggerian philosophy.
Yeah,
you know, and Heidegger is like the Western logos is over, right? Metaphysics is over. But the weird thing is that the traditionalists are all about metaphysics at the same time.
Mm.
So it's like a denial of metaphysics, and at the same time, saying that we need metaphysics. It's like doublespeak. It's like contradictory.
Right. All right.
So he's playing the postmodernist worldview, and the empire worldview, and he wants to just kind of ignore modernism completely.
Mm.
He wants to just like pretend it's not there, or just describe it as something evil, just something terribly evil. You know, everything right. in the West is evil. Everything in modernity is evil. And so, so he makes this entire, the West is the Antichrist, basically.
So what is Kali Yuga anyhow, before we go on, because you will mention that term?
Yeah. So there's in Hindu mythologies, there's four stages of civilization. And it moves from the stage of, you know, the golden age, basically. This is actually, you have to dive a little bit deeper into traditionalism, because René Guénon, who was the biggest influence on the traditionalists, had this theory. He was equating the four stages of the Kali Yuga to the gold, silver, bronze, and Iron Age.
Oh, right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So there's these four ages, and we're, of course, in the Kali Yuga, or you could call it the Iron Age as well. And it's the age of collapse and degeneration, but it's also the age where you start to see, yeah, the Iron Age.
Oh, right. I mean, okay. Mm-hmm.
It's the last age in a cycle. And the cycle is, you know, this is from, I guess, the Greco-Roman mythology. The cycle is gold, silver, bronze, and lead. I mean, iron. So we're in the Kali Yuga, which is, Guénon equates with the Iron Age.
Okay,
That's the age of degeneration. But the interesting thing about the Kali Yuga, it's the age of degeneration, but you can actually see the next golden age coming through at the same time.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I think we will get to that point. Yes.
Yeah. So, okay, I can continue to read here because...
Yeah, go ahead.
We're on that path. Okay, embracing and accelerating the chaos of the Kali Yuga and destroying evil liberalism of the West has been Dugin's overt and perverse spiritual fantasy for years now. He has helped create a war that will not lead to the redemption of the Holy Russian Empire, quite the opposite. In reality, Russian leadership has become the caricature Antichrist that Dugin thinks he is fighting against in the West. It's Dugin against Dugin, to quote Charles Upton's book title. Furthermore, because of the graphic horror transmitted into our devices 24/7, the fog of war has installed itself in our most intimate spaces. Will the shock of the daily images and videos help us make this kind of war illegal and impossible in the future? Will Ukraine result in a massive peace movement bigger than Vietnam? Or is this the end game of human civilization? An almost universal condemnation and mobilization against the war is already in progress. That is the good news. Maybe the war in Ukraine is actually a sign of the apocalypse at the end of the Kali Yuga cycle, if you like Hindu metaphors. Kali means time, while Yuga means world age. So time, the destroyer, right?
Right.
In Indian mythology, after the apocalypse of Kali Yuga, history continues into a new cycle. But what does that mean? Importantly, apocalypse is not the same thing as Armageddon. It is a painful awakening, but not the end of the world. Apocalypse means to reveal and uncover all of our civilization's hidden pathologies and clowns. In this strange existential space, Dugin is the clown of chaos. Like the post-truth Joker in the Joker movie, he is the mirror image of the resentful modern nihilist he criticizes. His mythopoetic Russian folk fantasies have done untold harm. They are merely social constructions without essence and have more to do with postmodern chaos than whatever the Russian collective soul might be. Dugin knows that these are apocalyptic times, and he would like to exploit the current chaos in his favor. Okay, so...
A lot to unpack here.
I think that the point I'm trying to make here is that I'm trying to sort of steel man the traditionalists and the Kali Yuga and say this is, you know, very interesting. Because we do seem to be at the end of a certain kind of age and the beginning of a new age. So we do seem to be in this in-between space. And we do have this sort of potential for apocalypse and also the potential for a different kind of world, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but at the same time, what's so interesting, what you're mentioning, the war of attention, it is you know, a new kind of war. You're mentioning, you know, the images, daily images of shock and horror transmitted into our most intimate spaces, you know, and so the way the internet has changed the nature of war. I find that aspect very interesting, because it's like we don't, you know, this is one aspect that we see these images on our smartphones. But the other aspect is, of course, that, you know, you can mobilize basically a global culture in favor of Ukraine, you know, very, very rapidly. And you can sanction Russia without military means, just by shutting them basically off of the internet, you know? And so I find that...
And I got this from McLuhan, right? This is very much a McLuhan-esque analysis here.
Yeah.
McLuhan said that the reason that, you know, the Vietnam War was such a failure, publicly a failure, right?
Yeah.
Besides an actual failure, is that because of television.
Right.
Right? Because people cannot, because war becomes not a mythological thing anymore. It becomes a direct, intimate experience that everybody is sort of participating in.
Yeah.
This participatory media makes hot war very unpopular.
Yeah, yeah.
There's other problems. There's a Cold War going on, which is, you know, it becomes a war of information. So,
yeah,
moving away, like the hope would be that we're moving away from this kind of war that Putin's doing, and this kind of war is sort of anachronistic or really too dangerous to even contemplate, you know, being involved in.
Yeah.
I don't think war will go away, but, you know, because we're warriors.
No, but you're completely right. I think, like, in the Vietnam War, they had, like, a daily death tallies on the television, you know, so how many soldiers were killed and you know, the gruesome pictures of the atrocities the you know, the U.S. Army were doing over there.
We're experiencing that again, even more so, because everybody with a cell phone is participating in the journalism, right?
Right. Interesting.
So that's kind of like, if the McLuhan-esque analysis is good, then what happens is the war just collapses on itself. It can't sustain itself.
Yeah.
Because it can't, like with radio, you can hypnotize a population, you know, into becoming a whole population, into becoming fanatical. You have to have a completely closed media system.
Yeah.
Like in North Korea, they have a completely closed media. And I guess I will see if Russia can manage that.
Yeah, in a way, propaganda is impossible to maintain by this.
Yeah, but that's what Zach was saying in his article about propaganda, that we can't really do propaganda anymore like we used to because of the internet.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, maybe, in the sense that a lot of Russian people will still have, I don't know, have information or still get information about what's happening, even if the official channels are telling me the
opposite. Someone playing the flute at your end, or what's happening?
Yeah, sorry about
that. No, worry about it.
That's a broken vacuum cleaner. Sounds very musical.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
Do you want me to go?
But before we go on, I think the sentiment that, you know, I get from all of this is that this is indeed a critical point in time, you know, and so I think it was Francis Fukuyama who coined the term the end of history, of course, and he was writing about that, I think, in the 90s or so. And I think we're like at the bifurcation where we can, you know, transform the way we do war, let's say, or conflict, and enter a true interconnected end of history, because, you know, at least for a certain period.
End of the Kali Yuga is the end of history. I didn't think of that connection, because it's the end of the history of our particular world epoch.
Exactly. Or it's end of history in terms of, okay, the only thing left on this planet will be cockroaches.
No? Yes, right. It could be the end of the existential end, or it could actually just be the one, you know, what the Kali Yuga is not as depressing as you would think. It's not, as I said, it's not Armageddon.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world. It's just the end of a bunch of things that aren't working.
Yeah.
And most of our sort of institutions, as we know, don't seem to be working very well. And I haven't adapted to whatever the new epoch is.
Yeah. Yeah, super interesting. Go on, Andrew.
Okay. So where was I? Yes, in the strange existential space, Dugin is the clown of chaos. Like the post-truth Joker and the Joker mirror. Oh, no, I read that already.
Yeah. And okay. Apocalypse is also, yeah.
Next. An apocalypse is also the harbinger of a new world. It happens when all of the current modes of civilization are revealed to be insufficient. Incidentally, Hindu mythology is not the same as Nietzsche's eternal return of the same or Dugin's reversal of history, but a new historical cycle. According to mythology, there is no going back to a golden age, but there could be a new golden age after the silver, bronze, and iron age are exhausted. We do seem to inhabit the space between worlds, as Zach Stein puts it, between one massive paradigm and the next.
Exactly, yeah.
So, there's something about the, it's not the eternal return of the same that Nietzsche talked about. In fact, this is Dugin's problem. He's too much of a Nietzschean, right?
Right.
And according to, this is what I'm getting from Charles Upton's book, that it's kind of a vulgarization of the Hindu mythology, which is like, there's a cycle and then a new cycle begins. It's not that we go back, right?
Yeah.
Dugin's whole thing is that, you know, we're going to reverse history in some way. He wants to reverse history. He has this idea of reversing history.
Yeah.
Because he wants to go back to some golden age. He wouldn't say that, but he does talk about the reversal.
Yeah.
But it's not that, yeah, but that's not correct. It's that there's these cycles of history, and then there's a new cycle of history. So the era of time goes forward. It never goes back.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking about that, you know, end of history appears also periodically, you know, so you get to a new stage and, you know, I imagine some new form, a new West, let's say, you know, like an interconnected West where different rules apply and where for a couple of years we create a form of stability, you know, a new end of history until the next paradigm is emerging, let's say.
Well, the idea of, you know, Dugin's idea of the multipolar world is great. That's what we want. We don't want a unipolar world, you know, dominated by the United States, you know,
yeah,
it's correct
yeah.
about that. We do want this multipolar world where every country is sort of expressing its essence, right?
Right.
You know, the Russians are you know, creating great literature again or doing great music, and you know they've discovered their essence, right?
Right. Although I must say, I know what you mean. It's always complicated, you know, this term essence, you know.
Because this is the whole thing. It's the traditionalists believe there's an essence to things. The postmodernists believe there is no essence, and it's just a nihilistic point of view, right?
Right.
So is there an essence?
I think of it more like a shared history and a shared characteristics that create some sort of attractor basin, you know, that creates some
events. you could call that an essence.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Like, not something static, it's something that's moving.
Yeah.
And it's dynamic and alive, but it's not just nothing. It's not just something you invent or create or, you know.
Yeah, but it's
so
yeah,
again, the critique of Dugin is that he's just making all this shit up. He's taking a little bit of Heidegger, and he's taking a little bit of Russian Orthodoxy, and he's taking a little bit of whatever he likes and mixing it all together. But it's full of contradictions and
right.
paradoxes.
No, I'm not against the idea. I'm just saying essence and soul. These are like complicated and religious terms, you know. And you know, I think there's a shared history, let's say, of the people of Russia or Germany or France or whatever. But essence, or like, there's even a book, it's called The Soul of Nations. And it's like, I understand where the author is getting it, you know, and what he wants to describe, but he does it in these quasi-religious terms that undermine every effort he's, you know, going to do in this book and, you know, is about to do in this book. And
well, that's a good description of what what Dugin is doing. He wants
this
multipolar world,
mm.
But he's using all this esoteric descriptions. And actually, it's more like he wants a world of good versus evil. You know,
yeah,
he wants this massive polarized.
Yeah.
world, and he has a very clear definition of what evil is. And evil is anything that's liberal, that's Western.
I mean, there's even language. As far as I understand, language also is dependent on geology. And so if you have like two different tribes, like separated by, let's say, a mountain, or like so they have a different geology and different, you know, aspects of ecology and nature. So their language will develop differently, and they will develop a different, you know, history.
Of course.
And so you could say that's then their essence, but I think that kind of misses the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it depends what you think archetypes are. Are there actual archetypes or because obviously we know what the dark side of that is. It's this essentialism, which leads to, you know, all of the different kinds of racist nationalism, etc. But the funny thing about Dugin is he says he's not a nationalist. He says he's, you know, he's more like, it's weird. He wants to bring back Imperial Russia.
Right.
And that's the fantasy that Putin is latching on.
Yeah.
Which is very odd, and it's very anachronistic.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. For me, archetypes are like primordial scenes that we represent in pictures and images and stories, you know.
Yeah, what's a Russian? I mean, a Russian is something, it's not nothing.
No, exactly. And so what Dugin, as far as I follow your argument, what he is trying to do is to invoke, you know, a certain type of archetype or a certain type of egregore or whatever, you know, and change the course of history in that sense.
Yeah, he's playing God. He's creating the egregore.
Yeah.
Which makes him a demonic figure.
Right. All right, Andrew, go ahead.
So, but even if we are in the so-called Kali Yuga or the end of the Iron Age, our lives are still improving. Contrary to public opinion, there's less starvation, madness, and war in the world today than there ever was. Compare COVID to the Black Plague, and compare the present string of proxy wars to the 19th and 20th century bloodbaths. Fewer people today are dying of hunger. There are more trees in Europe and Africa. And while there is fallout from new technology and existential risks, like global warming to deal with, I would argue that these are still the best of times to be alive. This is evidenced by the fact that we live in a time when hot war is reviled and not romanticized. Even the Chinese seem to be holding Russia at a distance for its brutality. Remember, this is also the internet age, not the age of industrial capitalism or feudalism. Today's war is a war of information, where nuclear weapons feel like anachronisms. Could Putin's war be a significant regression before a considerable step forward?
Yeah, we were already talking about this. So you
can go on. Already spoke about that. My insight is that, okay, so let's use this Kali Yuga mythology for a minute and say, you know, we're at the end of the Kali Yuga age, which means that it's not actually, we're not in the thick of the Kali Yuga age. You know, the thick of the Kali Yuga age might have been the 20th century, right?
Yeah.
With the Holocaust and the First and Second World War and all that, and then, you know, all this. Whereas things are better now. I mean, this helps me understand, like, I know the traditionalists are always saying that we're in, you know, modernism is evil and terrible, and right? The people who are very religious and orthodox, and then the modernists are always saying, naively, that, these are the best of times and blah, blah, blah. And in a way, I'm trying to put those two things together.
Right.
To say, yes, we're living in an age of fragmentation and loss of identity and all of these things, and we don't know who we are, and we don't know what our religion, you know, but at the same time, we're also living in a better world in so many ways, a kinder world. People are more against war than ever and that sort of thing. So I'm trying to put these two things together.
Right. No, I get it. I think, you know, the interesting point you're making also is that you can't isolate that event, you know, the Ukraine war, because it's one event in a larger scheme of things. You know, because you mean you mentioned the loss of identity, and you have the war on women. You know, with, you know, what is a woman? Nobody knows apparently what a woman is nowadays, or is allowed.
Well, this
to
is
say.
The loss of essence, the postmodern loss of essence.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
Essence of anything. So it's a total deconstruction of everything, and in that way, Dugin's argument is right. You know, he's right to criticize that.
Right, but he comes from a different, you know, from the regressive angle.
Right, but he wants to create this reified essence of holy Russia and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
While at the same time celebrating the chaos of the Kali Yuga, you know, and accelerationism.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like the guy who's playing both sides of the, he's on both teams at once.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Next section is Hot War versus Cold War,
which is Marshall McLuhan's, you know, talked about hot and cool media. And he also talked about hot war and Cold War. So Marshall McLuhan has pointed out that during the Cold War in Vietnam, the public did not want a hot war. Vietnam failed, he claimed, because of cool media, specifically television. According to McLuhan, soap and car commercials, rock and roll and sitcoms ended conscription and the power of the Ku Klux Klan in America. Indeed, new media and consumer capitalism have created new spiritual problems, and America continued its proxy wars underground. However, the point is that the intimacy of the Vietnam War was too much for people. Napalm babies were too horrible for the cozy living room.
Indeed. Mm.
Again, in the internet age, war is no longer a romantic occupation for aristocrats and empires. The age of Napoleon is over. The 20th century is all over. With radio and newspapers, war is hot. It hypnotized populations into nationalism, communism, fascism, and mass genocide. But the technological intimacy of video and images makes war too intimate and real for any empire to contain or manage through propaganda. Today, nobody can be indifferent to the present horrors coming out of Ukraine. No moral argument for Putin's actions can be sustained, except by freak conspiracy groups. Only the resentful and the power-lusting weirdos like Dugin could promote such a holy war with their comic book mythologies. Hence, a hot or holy war is too obscene and anachronistic to be admitted to, therefore, special operations. And I doubt the Dugin-Putin doublespeak will not wholly hit. I doubt the holy, that's a typo there, actually.
Yep.
And I doubt the Dugin-Putin doublespeak will wholly hypnotize Russia. News and images get filtered through, and many Russians are against the war. A lie cannot sustain itself indefinitely. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the point, and I don't know, you know, in terms of hot and cold war, I think the thing, and this is, again, I'm not an expert, but it seems to me that the war in Ukraine, the rationale is already run its course in a kind of sense. And the only reason why Putin continues to do that is that he wants to poke, you know, the West and NATO in order to create a hot war, you know? And so, so in a way, it seems that this is my impression. He wants to go back to this era when hot war was kind of sexy, you know, and mythologized.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. He wants to. He thinks. I guess he wants to be Napoleon in some kind of way. It's just that's what he wants. That's what, or he wants to be Tsar Nicholas. More accurately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or he's also a social justice warrior, you know.
Identitarian
and all of these things, which he's criticizing, and the hypocrisy is
yeah, but the interesting thing of what you're pointing out is like the clash of worldviews, you know, because you know.
Well, the similarity of the you know the clash like. The similarity of the difference.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I was trying to say with Dugin is that he's his worst enemy in a sense. He's his ideology resembles so much the ideology that, he loathes and despises in the West.
It's interesting, or, because
that he's branded as being pure evil, like he's a total postmodernist.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, like, when you talk about the presence of the difference, you know, the similarity of the difference, it's like, okay, we're claiming in our West that our way is kind of better or advanced, like the traditional way, you know, or the way of the old ways, you know. Now we have internet and the sensitivities we have, and, you know, but in some ways it seems to me that this conflict is about to show if that is true, if without with the means that we have at our disposal, that we can dissolve this conflict, you know, without falling into a hot war. And so it's like a test.
It's a test, yeah. It feels that way, yeah, that's right. That makes sense to me.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I think that in the 21st century paradigm, hot war is just dead. It's way too dangerous.
It's
nearly impossible. Like, what's going on right there? It's just right on the razor's edge. Like, just one nuke and it's all over.
Yeah.
So we can't keep walking the razor's edge like this. So that's, in a way, it's the terror of the situation, as Gurdjieff would call it.
Yeah.
But it's also the possibility of the situation, because when we realize that we can't do this anymore, you know, that our conflict has to be worked out in different ways.
Yeah. What is the deal anyhow with Kim Jong-un? He was like,
who?
Yeah, the leader of North Korea, who was like showcasing his nuclear arsenal a couple of days ago. So what is his stance on the Ukraine-Russia conflict?
No, I have no idea. I haven't been paying attention to North Korea. But.
All right, okay. Anyhow, go on, Andrew.
Okay. I'm somewhat optimistic that special operations collapse on itself with these reasons. The reasons I mentioned before in the article.
Yeah.
What will happen in the aftermath of the war? As Rabbi Manus Friedman says, peace is not good enough. It is just a pause between war. We have to go deeper than peace. How about ending hot wars forever? The eternal adversary, the scapegoat, the demon of war needs to be exorcised. Today, it is already fundamentally impossible to go to war with Russia. For one thing, because Russia has more nukes than America. Somehow, we will have to let Russia defeat itself, lose the moral argument, become intolerant of the lie it is telling itself. Russia could become the great spiritual holy land that Dugin dreams about, but only if it repents of its endless lies and is exhausted of its cruelty. Dugin's fantasy is the worst kind of postmodern dream. It has nothing to do with eschatology or warnings in prophetic literature, with Hopi prophecies to the Book of Revelations. Dugin has read Martin Heidegger and Nietzsche, but not René Girard. He doesn't understand it, that scapegoating makes the multipolar world impossible. But like a good postmodernist, he does not really believe in truth, only in power and his own fantasy life. Rather than a multipolar world, he is locked in a circle of eternal wars of opposites. However, the good news is that the crack in everything is shining through. Today, we're in the bottleneck of a significant phase transition, where none of our institutions or ideologies will save us. However, the negativity of the present might help us glimpse an actual future. We are a long way from the golden age, but there are signs of a better world coming through the fog. Yes, we need to let Russia find its eternal logos and China its Tao, and America be the land of the free for that matter. Dugin is right about one thing. A multipolar world is desirable. However, it cannot exist by creating more chaos and dirty wars. Kali, the great destroyer, will not be kind to Putin and his pseudo-Rasputin.
Right, there you have it. Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So, yeah, so I'm arguing for, yes, there are essences to you know, the places and countries, and they need to find themselves, and that's what the history is all about, in a way.
Yeah.
And we lose ourselves, and then we rediscover ourselves, and Kali comes and just destroys everything, and then you have new civilizations, and you know, and so it's the exhaustion of an epoch. Kali is, again, means time as well as the destroyer. So time, an epoch of time exhausts itself. And then a new epoch of time like emerges, right? Just right. Like, you know, the Silver Age became the Bronze Age and all that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the interesting thing is that I think that's the basic argument of Gebser's, Jean Gebser's, you know, our perspectival, you know, idea that there's always like this transition, this transformations and mutations. That he has not a developmental stage theory going on, but he talks about, you know, ways of how we conceptualize space, and now we're conceptualizing time in the art perspectival world. And you could say it's something like you know, the step into integral in the Wilbur kind of lingo, but yes. There's not an evolutionary ladder like a Jacob's ladder going on.
Well, it's more like these big cycles. It's more like a spiral again. Than a ladder.
Yeah, and so, but what Gebser is saying that the very basic question is not our discovery of space, but you know, the dimensions of time. And so you just, you know, and so like, because time is not like just a, you know, the clock time, you know, 1 second after another. These are phases. And like, there can be like different time bubbles, you know, exist at the same time, you know, at the same moment, let's say.
Yeah. And I was also thinking about the fact that how Dugin sort of mistakes the outer for the inner. How he projects everything onto the world that is actually really it's the apocalypse that you go through in your own life, and all these cycles, and so it's like they're happening on a microcosm, microcosmic and a macrocosmic level.
What is his background anyhow? It's like, what, you know, what is his, you know, the main points, you know, of his biography? Because now he's what, 76. He's like, where does he come from?
Well, I know he was sort of an anti-communist. He fought the communists and so he's kind of, I would say that he's a scholar that's also a activist. So whatever has been going on, he's always been very, you know, much of an activist. I think he took part in some of the wars, like in Chechnya. I'm not sure exactly. I don't know it very well.
His biography. Right. But what you're like, basically saying, he's like the Steve Bannon of Russia at the moment.
Oh, well, that analogy has been made for forever. Yeah, he's definitely considered to be the speed. He knows Steve Bannon. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, there's many similarities between the two, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they met in a hotel room once in Italy and had this long conversation, and Steve Bannon tried to convince him that the American folk, you know, are going to save the world, you know, need to be aligned with the Russian folk, because
right,
Dugin talks about the Volker, you know, the Russian peasant. And Steve Bannon, of course, working class American people. And so there's this sort of they merge on those points, but they didn't come into any agreement, apparently. You know,
right. Okay.
Because Dugin wasn't having anything to do with America.
Yeah.
As having much hope or whatever.
Yeah.
He just basically sees America as the Antichrist.
Yeah. Also, they met. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. There's also this whole mythology about the civilian world, and it's really wild stuff, Dugin. It's really the civilian world is I don't know, civil, I think, eats her children or something.
Oh, well, okay.
He says there's Apollo and Dionysus. And there's Sibyl.
Okay.
And the Apollonians are let's say the ones, the empires, the ones who those who, you know, keep order and stability and hierarchy in the society. And the Dionysians are the Russian peasants, basically.
Yeah.
Something like that. And the Sibylians are kind of the capitalists who go around raping and pillaging the world and eating their own children, and they Yeah, he also calls them the Atlanteans. I think civilians and the Atlanteans are the same. So from Atlantis, right? So
right.
They're like, you know, traders and pirates. And
yeah,
that's kind of how he sees the West. Whereas the West is this, or whereas Russia is this solid continent, Eurasia.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
but it's like a Lord of the Rings. His world. It's very fanciful. It's very interesting. But again, when you mix it with geopolitics, it gets dangerous.
Yeah.